I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down mandatory life sentences for juvenile offenders, saying it violated the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Writing for the majority in the 5-4 decision, Justice Elena Kagan said mandatory life without parole for juveniles precludes consideration of his chronological age and its hallmark features, among them immaturity, impetuosity, and failure to appreciate risks and consequences. Chief Justice John Roberts disagreed, writing, "If a 17-year-old is convicted of deliberately murdering an innocent victim, it's not unusual for the murderer to receive a mandatory sentence of life without parole." It's our topic for today's Radio Times. Two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Marcia Levick is a Deputy Director, Chief Counsel of the Juvenile Law Center. She co-authored an amicus brief filed with the U.S. Supreme Court on this case. And Marcia, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us is Lawrence Steinberg, professor of psychology at Temple University. His research focuses on adolescent development and particularly the cognitive, social, and emotional changes in the teen years. He is the lead scientist of an APA brief that was submitted before the court on this case as well. And nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks.
Let me begin with you, if I could, Marcia, and I just summarize very briefly what Elena Kagan said, writing for the majority. How significant is this ruling?
I think it's very significant. What the Supreme Court has done is really continue a path that it began in 2005 when it struck the juvenile death penalty, in reaffirming now repeatedly in four cases that kids are different and that youth status matters in constitutional law. And most importantly, it matters when we think about how we sentence juveniles who commit criminal conduct.
This struck down mandatory life without parole, but it seems like it also still gives some discretion to a judge who could decide that a juvenile offender deserves life without parole.
No question that the court's decision yesterday did not eliminate the possibility of imposing a sentence of life without parole on juveniles convicted of homicide. But removing the mandatory aspect of those sentences has profound and significant impact for roughly probably 2,000 juveniles currently who receive that sentence in the United States. Of course, it has enormous impact going forward. Mm-hmm. And I think importantly what it does is that it restores discretion to the sentencing court to make these decisions. And as Justice Kagan wrote, it requires that the individual attributes of youth be considered. And that makes a big difference when we talk about sentencing.
Well, let me turn back to you as the lead scientist for this APA amicus brief. And it seemed that the court, or at least the majority in the court, drew a lot on the kind of research that you have been doing.
They did, and I think increasingly over the course of time in Roper, which was the death penalty case, and then Graham, which was life without parole for non-homicide crimes, and this one, I think the court has now accepted the fact that there is good social and behavioral and neuroscience that supports the, I think, what most people take for granted, that adolescents are different from adults and that those differences matter for how we treat them under the law.
And when Justice Kagan talked about immaturity, impetuosity, failure to appreciate risks and consequences, was she referring specifically to the kind of work that you have been doing?
Yes, she was. But our group, which has been supported for a very long time now by the MacArthur Foundation, but by other funders as well, including NIH, right, has been studying age differences in these very aspects of functioning, impulsivity, thinking ahead, planning, weighing risk and reward, susceptibility to coercive influence. And in all of these domains, we find significant differences between teenagers and adults.
These two cases that were before the court involved criminals who committed serious violent crimes. They were 14 years old.
Yes, both of them were 14 years old at the time of their offenses, and there was actually some possibility that the court might have limited its ruling to only dealing with offenders who committed their crimes when they were 14 or younger. So I think that as an advocate, of course, we were thrilled to see that the court extended that ruling for all juveniles under the age of 18. It would have been odd if they hadn't, because their prior decisions, building on the research that Dr. Steinberg has done, didn't draw distinctions between 13-year-olds and 15-year-olds and 17-year-olds. So the court did, while it was confronted specifically with very young juveniles, it made its ruling broad.
But is there a difference? And this is, I guess, going back to some of the research that you're doing. Obviously, the court making this decision about juveniles, but the difference between, let's say, a 14-year-old, which was what these particular cases were about, and a 17-and-a-half-year-old, and how impulsive and impetuous they are.
Yeah, there are. One of the problems with drawing these, bright line boundaries is that most of these characteristics develop gradually. There's no magic age at which somebody turns from an adolescent into an adult. So the question is, given that, and given that there's variability among individuals of the same age in these things, where do you draw the line? Right. And I think that because we do draw the line for so many things at 18, under the law, that if there isn't any good reason to deviate from that, then that's where we ought to have the line for this, too.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. We all know that kids under the age of 18 can't vote, they can't serve on juries, they can't join the military, they also can't get tattoos, they can't go to tanning parlors. So we've made some very sweeping judgments about the capacity of kids under the age of 18 to make smart decisions about their lives. And I agree with Dr. Steinberg. There's no reason not to draw the line there. There's no good reason not to. It makes sense.
But it seemed that the minority, they had obviously some complaints about this decision. One, that the legislature should be able to decide about punishments within their own jurisdictions, but also, and I think this is what Justice Roberts was talking about, or Chief Justice Roberts talking about, that if someone is almost 18, do we hold them responsible the way we would an adult?
Well, again, we have to draw the line somewhere. We do it every day, and 18 is the number that actually every state has chosen to draw that line at, so why not abide by that? The other comment I would make with respect to the dissenters is that while states retain an enormous amount of legal authority, obviously, to enact criminal justice systems, to impose sentencing guidelines or sentencing decisions, the fact of the matter remains that the ultimate judgment about the constitutionality of any sentencing scheme rests with the Supreme Court. And that's what the majority did yesterday, was to make that judgment.
And go ahead. To really put this in perspective, if it were election day and somebody came to a voting place and said, well, I'm 17 and a half, I'm almost 18, why can't I vote? The answer would be, well, you can't vote until you're 18. So, as Marshall Levick said, we have to draw the line someplace, and that's where we've chosen to draw it for virtually all purposes under the law.
Well, as we all know, most teenagers do not commit crimes. So help us understand, for those who do, and in this particular case, these were violent crimes, what do we know about why a teenager would commit a crime?
Well, I think that teenagers commit crimes for different reasons. Most of them commit crimes because they make risky and reckless and bad choices, a lot of times when they're with their friends. One of these cases involved a 14-year-old who was with his friends, and he didn't even do the shooting that killed the victim in this particular case. On the other hand, there are some adolescents who are very troubled, who are, I think, antisocial, and who are individuals that sometimes pose a threat to the community. What I think is important is that 90% of the juveniles who commit offenses during their teen years do not grow up to be adult criminals. Distinguishing between, and maybe we can get into this later,
sure,
those who will and those who won't is very, very challenging.
We don't know, so we can't predict, in a sense, who will or who won't at this point.
That's right. And I'm not sure that we ever will, because a lot of it has to do with circumstances, and circumstances don't reside in the person's personality or brain. But study after study arrives at this 90% figure, and study after study finds that you can't predict who's going to be in the 90%.
But what it says is that young people can be largely rehabilitated.
Yes, and when the Supreme Court struck juvenile life without parole sentences 2 years ago in non-homicide cases, so completely prohibited them for that category of juvenile offender, the court took what Dr. Steinberg just said and really embedded it in its constitutional analysis by recognizing that you cannot make decisions at the outset. You can't make a decision on day one that any juvenile offender is incapable of being rehabilitated or reformed. And that's really what the parole system or any type of sentence review system is designed to provide. And as the court said in that case, and as I think Dr. Steinberg and I would say here today, some kids may never get out of prison.
Right.
That review process, as they go go on through life will give the parole board or any reviewing body more information. It may turn out that they're not getting it, they're not maturing, they're not changing, they won't get out. But we shouldn't deny the opportunity to the vast majority of juveniles who will be able to demonstrate that maturity.
But based on what the court did yesterday, if I'm a judge and a case comes before me, I don't have this mandatory thing hanging over my head. I can decide on a case-by-case basis.
Yes, and you as a judge could still decide to sentence that juvenile before you to juvenile life without parole. Justice Kagan wrote in her opinion that she expected that sentence would be uncommon because of this great difficulty to actually make these kinds of decisions in the beginning.
But does it empower judges? I mean, does it give judges a power or an authority that they didn't have before?
It gives judges complete authority now over the sentence. Before, it really was the legislature that had determined what sentence an individual would receive. And now it's up to the sentencing court to make those decisions.
And back to the kind of research that you've been doing for years now, based on what brain research, on just understanding what human development entails, is that what you're looking at?
Yes, and we're trying to get a better understanding of the ways in which behavior changes, judgment changes, and the neural underpinnings of behavior and judgment change. One thing that we're interested in and working on now in a different project is individual differences in these patterns. Because I think that the open question now is, if these cases are going to be adjudicated on a case-by-case basis, what are the factors that are going to be taken into account, and how are those factors taken into account? And are they factors that are the right factors to take into account, and are they factors that are clearly the wrong factors? So one major concern, I think, is that race will play a role in sentencing decisions, and it shouldn't. But it will, given what we know about race in other sentencing contexts.
But we're almost up in a break here, but even when looking at these neural underpinnings, you still think that race will play a role?
Well, we're not at a point now where someone can bring in a brain scan into court and say, look at my client. My client has an immature or a normally developing brain. We're not there yet, and it will be quite some time before we're there.
You agree with that?
I do. I think that, like the capital cases in the death penalty arena, where we have mitigation and mitigating and aggravating factors that are presented to the jury in capital cases to make that judgment between life and death, there will have to be a set of criteria and factors, mitigators and aggravators, that will have to be recognized for juveniles. It won't be the same. It's an analogous situation, but not identical, because youth and the attributes of youth are distinctly relevant to this determination now for juvenile life without parole, perhaps not so much in capital cases where you're dealing with older defendants.
But things like upbringing and
upbringing, family experience, family environment, educational background, what kinds of drivers were present in the juvenile's life that led to the kinds of decisions that they made.
Well, we are talking about yesterday's Supreme Court decision that essentially struck down mandatory life sentences for juvenile offenders. Talking with Marsha Levick, a chief counsel of the Juvenile Law Center, and Lawrence Steinberg, professor of psychology at Temple University. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Food waste disposers grind up your food scraps and send them through the sewer system to Philadelphia's wastewater treatment plants, where they're converted into renewable energy and fertilizer. More information at philadelphiastreets.com. Incinerator supports WHYY.
Hi, this is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. This year, WHYY celebrated the first anniversary of Newsworks Tonight and the 25th anniversaries of Fresh Air and Radio Times. WHYY's fiscal year ends this Saturday, June 30th. As we prepare for the next fiscal year and beyond, I hope you'll consider making a donation at whyy.org or by calling us at 1-888-345-9499. Thanks.
Next time in Studio 360, it looks human, but changes at night to satisfy its horrible appetites.
I just kept the parts of the myth that I thought were cool. Silver bullets, I mean, silver's fantastic. Why would you want to ditch that?
Werewolves and the writer who loves them. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
WHYY, through American Graduate, is now offering scholarships to teachers of grades 7 through 12 for visual storytelling basics for the classroom at WHYY's Hamilton Commons. Apply for your scholarship at whyy.org/American Graduate.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about the fact that yesterday the U.S. Supreme Court struck down mandatory life sentences without parole for juvenile offenders. It was a 5-4 ruling. Pennsylvania has the highest number of these prisoners in the country. We're talking with Marsha Levick, Chief Counsel of the Juvenile Law Center, and Temple University Psychology Professor Lawrence Steinberg. And we're taking calls. We're curious about where you stand on what the court did yesterday. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Marsha, I'm just curious because I read it was something like 480 prisoners in Pennsylvania prisons who committed crimes as juveniles. Is that the right number?
Yes,
is that the number you're working
with? It's difficult to get an exact number, but we think the number is just around 470 or 480.
But you don't know.
We are reasonably certain, based on looking through records, the ages at which juveniles went into the prisons, the ages at which their trials and convictions occurred. So we're pretty certain that's the right number.
And why does Pennsylvania have so many of these particular prisoners?
I think one of the obvious reasons is that in Pennsylvania, juvenile life without parole is a mandatory sentence in both first and second degree murder. So first degree murder is premeditated, intentional murder. Second degree murder in Pennsylvania is felony murder. Felony murder is when the individual is convicted of a homicide crime, but he wasn't the shooter, he wasn't the trigger man, he might have been driving the car, he might not have been present when the crime occurred at all, but had some connection to the individuals who committed it. We transfer intent, is what we call it in the law, but those individuals also, if convicted, will receive, up to this point, have received a mandatory life without parole sentence.
Does that make then Pennsylvania tougher than other states on these particular kinds of?
We are one of just a few states in the country that imposes this sentence as a mandatory matter on both first and second degree. Yes.
And if, let's say, a 17-year-old is sentenced to prison, do they go to an adult prison then? If they get this mandatory life sentence, they go to an adult prison?
Yes, they do. In fact, if they're 13 years old, they go to an adult prison. We do have one prison in Pennsylvania that was established for younger juvenile offenders in the adult system, but the fact of the matter is that they are not segregated from adult offenders, and they are in the same prison system that we send our adult offenders to.
And when they're on trial, is it an adult trial that they get, or is it within the juvenile system?
If they are charged as adults, in which case they would be subject to this life without parole sentence. They're tried as adults. They're in the criminal justice system. They have a right to jury trials, which juveniles do not have in Pennsylvania and most states across the country. So they are receiving the same kinds of procedural protections that criminal defendants receive, yet they are obviously, as the research tells us, woefully ill-equipped to enter into that adult criminal justice system.
Because they're young.
Yes.
Or certainly younger. Do you want to weigh in on that? I'm just curious about, as a psychologist, that your perspective.
I wanted to make an additional comment about felony murder, and it's very perplexing to think about charging an adolescent with felony murder, because so much of felony murder has to do with an assessment of whether you should have anticipated that this terrible thing would have happened. So that if you and your friends are in a convenience store and one of them decides to rob somebody and shoot somebody, should you, as a 16-year-old or 15-year-old or 14-year-old, have recognized that because your friend had a gun, maybe you didn't even know that your friend had a gun, that you shouldn't have been there, shouldn't have been a part of this group at that time? So it seems to me an especially unjust charge to put upon a teenager, given the fact that we know that one of the things teenagers are not very good at is thinking ahead and anticipating the consequences of their actions.
And also the power of the peer group as well.
That's right.
Does that sort of muddy their thinking?
Well, in our research, we've been studying this for quite some time now. What we find is that just being around your peers undermines judgment and decision-making among teenagers in a way that it doesn't among adults. Now, no parents who are listening will be surprised to hear that, because most of them would agree that their teenagers do things with their friends that are much more reckless and risky and dumb than they would do if they were by themselves. But because so much juvenile crime is committed in groups, it really is a very, very important factor in making decisions about how culpable an adolescent is.
We've been focusing on these juvenile offenders, but obviously, Marcia, there are victims in these crimes as well. And we in fact, we have a guest waiting in the wings, but we must not forget that the victims pay, obviously, the ultimate price if we're talking about murder here.
The victims do pay the ultimate price, and their families pay the ultimate price. And it's difficult to have this kind of conversation today where we as advocates may celebrate the decision that the Supreme Court made yesterday because it made what we believe is a correct decision as a matter of constitutional law. Mm-hmm. It doesn't change the grief or the pain that families have experienced. It doesn't bring back their family members. But we hopefully at some point can get to an appreciation that we live in a constitutional democracy and we expect our Supreme Court at the end of the day to make these kinds of judgments about how we can function as a society.
Because we're obviously talking about, you know, crimes that have been committed, people that have paid with their lives, and obviously juvenile offenders on top of that. Again, talking about yesterday's Supreme Court ruling, our guests are Marcia Levick, Deputy Director, Chief Counsel of the Juvenile Law Center, which she co-founded back in 1975, co-author of an amicus brief that was filed before the U.S. Supreme Court on this case that was decided yesterday. Also with us is Lawrence Steinberg. He's a professor of psychology at Temple University, and his research focuses on adolescent development. He's written a number of books and also was the lead scientist in the APA brief that was submitted before the court on this case. Again, lines open. Any questions or comments or reactions you might have, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, talking about victims, I want to get to Daryl Romig to join our conversation. In 2003, his 12-year-old daughter, Danny, was brutally murdered by a juvenile named Brian Barr, who was serving life without parole in Pennsylvania. And Daryl Romig, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, and please accept all of our sympathies for what happened to your daughter.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Is this hard for you to talk about?
It's hard for me to talk about, but, I mean, I'm standing up for what happened, and I do whatever I can and whatever I have to do.
Not to belabor what happened to your daughter, but I do want to make sure our audience understands what happened to her back in 2003. She was 12 years old, and how was she murdered?
She was taken down the street to a creek. He had raped her, he had beat her, and then strangled her and threw her half of her into a creek.
Mm. And he was someone in the neighborhood, Brian?
Yes, he was a kid that was maybe about a block down the street from my house.
And was he known as a troublemaker?
He actually was not known as a troublemaker. He used to play with my neighbor two doors over. He used to play with his son all the time. Mm-hmm. He tormented dogs and stuff like that, but that was really about it.
He tormented dogs, you said?
Yes, he tormented dogs. My one neighbor had a dog. He used to torment the dog a little bit, but mm-hmm. It was never nothing really major.
Now, I know that your daughter was missing for some time, and you and your family and neighbors are looking for her. She, you know, sadly was found. What did you know or what did you learn about Brian Barr?
We really didn't know too much of him at first until they had did the investigation and found out more about him. We just knew that he had some problems with his family, with his dad and stuff and things like that. He was a quiet kid in school. He really didn't bother with anybody.
He did have this list, 23 things to do to a girl in the woods?
Yes, they had found the list in one of his books in his book bag, 23 things to do to a girl when you got him in the woods, and unfortunately he accomplished most of them.
And he was what, found guilty?
Yes, he was found guilty.
And sentenced to life in prison without parole?
Yes, that's correct.
So I'm just curious about your response to what the Supreme Court ruled yesterday. What's your response to that?
It's a major blow to us because it's just something that we thought we'd never have to worry about going back to court for anything, you know, seeing anything, hearing anything. It just ripped open old wounds, and it really hurts.
The thought, obviously, that if his case goes before a judge again, that you will have to go back to court again?
Yes. I mean, my health, I became disabled a few weeks before we lost my daughter, and my health had went downhill for a while because of all the hearings, the trials and stuff that we had to go through. And once everything was settled and done, my health actually went back, got a little bit better. Now I find this out, and it's just a real big blow to me.
Indeed. Where is Brian being held?
The last I known, he was being held at Camp Hill. They do transfer him every once in a while, but we do get a notice where they transfer him to.
And do you know how he has behaved in prison at all? Have you followed his case, or is that just too painful?
I try not to follow it too much, but my understanding is I have people that do keep me updated on things. He keeps himself away from the open, everybody else. He's a troublemaker in prison. He's been known to throw feces, his urine, cause problems to keep himself locked up at all times.
Mm-hmm. So this ruling yesterday, has that kind of reopened some wounds for you and your family?
Yes, it has. I got a phone call yesterday from a friend of mine, and I seen it on the internet on Facebook, and it's like it just took a real big low blow to me. It's like this mm-hmm. is, I never thought something like this would come down, that we'd have to go through all this all over again.
And I would imagine, I can only imagine, that losing a child the way you did has got to be, you know, one of the most painful things a parent has to deal with.
Oh, my God, it was one of the worst things I ever had to face. I mean, I've never thought I'd have to bury one of my own children. I mean, she was my firstborn. And to bury her, it just literally ripped a piece of me out, and it's never going to be replaced. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's always going to be with me in my heart, but she's just not there physically for me.
Yeah, and that's got to be so painful. Are you, though, worried that Brian will be released? I mean, it sounds like he's a troubled person who has had trouble even in prison.
Yeah, he's had some trouble past, from my understanding. And I am concerned about it, because I don't think it's fair that he takes a life that we will never get back, and if he gets released, he gets his life back.
Mm-hmm. Let me just see if I can get my guests to respond, and they're listening very carefully, Daryl, to what you're saying, and let me give Larry Steinberg a chance to weigh in first. Larry, your thoughts?
Well, first let me say that, you know, my heart goes out to Daryl. I'm a parent as well, and I imagine that I would feel very similarly if God forbid, you know, my family went through something like this. So there are really no words of comfort one can provide in these sorts of matters. This juvenile sounds, now a young man, sounds like a very, very troubled person, probably right. mentally ill in some way. I think given his behavior in prison, as Daryl described, it is highly unlikely that he will be released. Because the misbehavior in prison is a pretty good predictor of continued antisocial behavior afterwards. So I think that one can never be certain, but this seems to me to be one of these very low probability cases. Yeah. And I just want to remind our listeners that the court yesterday did not take life without parole off the table as an option. And perhaps there are some circumstances under which some of us would correctly feel that a juvenile had done something that was so heinous and the juvenile is so dangerous that we really have no other choice. Who's to say what would happen today if this case for the first time came before a court again?
Mm. Daryl, I do want to turn to Marshall Levick as well, but anything you want to say in response to what Larry just said?
No, I mean, I do understand what he is saying.
Right. Marcia?
Well, I echo Dr. Steinberg's sentiments, Daryl, in terms of your own loss that you experienced. I think that as for the work that I do as a lawyer and as someone who is really primarily on the defense side in the criminal justice system, I recognize the difficulty that victims face, and I fully appreciate your statement, and it's something that we hear so often about having to revisit the pain that you've already experienced. The problem, obviously, with anticipating parole eligibility hearings or other kinds of sentencing review opportunities or even a resentencing in this case is it does place you as the family member of a victim in the terrible position of potentially having to retell your story all over again. And as a parent as well, I can only imagine, as I think we've all said here, how horrible that surely will be for you. But I also, really as an intellectual matter, at least recognize that it is the job of our system to balance both your rights as a victim and to balance the rights of offenders, and to try to figure out where we can find some equilibrium between the interests and rights of both sides. And I think that in a way what the court did yesterday provided that, in the sense that it allows for the possibility, as Dr. Steinberg reiterated, life without parole isn't off the table for juveniles. There will be cases where it will undoubtedly be imposed tomorrow and reimposed in the cases of juveniles who are currently serving it in Pennsylvania, based upon what is now an unconstitutional sentencing scheme. And it may be also, I think, that there will be efforts to figure out how to minimize the retelling of the story in cases where there is parole eligibility, because I think there is a growing sensitivity to how difficult and painful that is for families themselves.
Daryl, I know that when he was sentenced, when Brian Barr was sentenced, your family, you and your family, did not want the death penalty. Is that correct?
That's correct. We did not want to go through all the trial with seeing the pictures of how they found her, where she was found. We didn't want to go through all that because it would have been too much for us.
Right. And death penalties obviously take years and years to resolve one way or the other.
Exactly. And like I said, with my health and my mother, it would have been too much for us. I mean, and to go through that for, you know, who knows for how many years we would have gone through that, it would have been way too much. I mean, I have two other kids to worry about as well.
Well, I so appreciate you joining us. And again, from all of us here in the studio and obviously people listening as well, please accept our sympathy for what happened to your daughter.
Well, I thank you for having me, and I appreciate everything.
You're very welcome. That's Daryl Romig joining us from the Allentown area here in Pennsylvania. Larry, he said something interesting that caught my eye or ear. Brian Barr hurt animals or was doing things to animals. Is that, you know, a sign that you're talking about ways of predicting behavior, but is that something that's significant to understand?
Well, I think it's mainly significant in that it sometimes is an indicator of an underlying mental illness. You know, we often hear in looking at hindsight at these things, well, this was a quiet person. He, you know, never did anything like this before and so forth. And, you know, the fact that he was tormenting animals says to me that there was probably something very wrong with this juvenile, and the fact that he was behaving the way he behaved, throwing feces and urine in prison, I think confirms the fact that this is not a normal adolescent or young adult, but somebody who suffers from a pretty profound mental illness.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. That's Lawrence Steinberg, professor of psychology at Temple University. Also with us is Marsha Levick, chief counsel of the Juvenile Law Center, talking about yesterday's Supreme Court ruling, saying that life without parole for juveniles who committed crimes under the age of 18 is no longer mandatory. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think of what the court did? Call us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The National Multiple Sclerosis Society supports WHYY and announces Bike MS City to Shore 2012. More than 7,000 cyclists of all ages and abilities will ride from Cherry Hill to Ocean City, New Jersey to help support a world free of MS. This ride is fully supported with catered rest stops, bike support, and SAG transportation. Cyclists can choose from a range of route options. To register, 800-455-BIKE or mscycling.org.
On the next Fresh Air, why so many American students finish college with crushing debt burdens. We speak with Kevin Carey, director of the Education Policy Program at the New America Foundation. He says tuitions have skyrocketed because colleges spend on big buildings, sports teams, and administration, and new lower-cost competitors may force them to change. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's daytime news magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up. plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, Here and Now. Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Lawrence Steinberg and Marshall Levick about yesterday's Supreme Court ruling, which struck down mandatory life sentences for juvenile offenders. It was a 5-4 ruling, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get David from Ambler to join our conversation. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Good show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that when we start talking about victims' rights, and I'm totally sympathetic with the horrible experience people experience with these murders of kids by kids and stuff, but when we go and talk about victims' rights, we get off course because there really is nothing in the Constitution about victims' rights. Victims don't have rights. The prisoner, the person who's arrested, has rights against cruel and unusual punishment, and that is the issue. Is the punishment cruel and unusual? If it is, that's it. That's the issue we're discussing. There's no such thing as victims' rights.
Well, let me see what Marshall
in the Constitution.
Well, let me see what Marshall Levick says. David, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
Well, I mean, David's right. Certainly, within the United States Constitution, there is nothing about victims' rights, and it is a constitutional document which goes a long way towards protecting the rights of individuals, and in particular, criminal defendants. There are state constitutional provisions around the country that do recognize victims' rights. There are statutory pieces of legislation that create victims' bill of rights. And I don't think that any one of us should be troubled or offended at the notion that victims have gained a voice in participating in the criminal justice system. I think their voice is an important one to be heard. The challenge that I think we're appropriately talking about here this morning is really striking that balance.
And I'm thinking about those victim statements that are given in a courtroom where a victim has a chance to, in a sense, confront the person that did them wrong, in a sense.
And not all victims want the perpetrator to suffer some horrible punishment. I think it would be incorrect to say that all victims are the same in terms of what they want to happen. Mm-hmm. And the question, you know, as Ms. Levick said, is how do you balance these different purposes of punishment in the criminal justice system?
We were talking to Daryl Roemig and his concern, of course, about reliving what happened to his daughter, killed by a 17-year-old, murdered by a 17-year-old, I should say. But, Marcia, there, let's say 480 cases. Are all these cases then going to be opened in Pennsylvania?
I think that they should be. I think because what we're looking at now is a situation where you have 480 individuals serving an unconstitutional sentence. And in order for that sentence to continue, there needs to be some reaffirmation by the sentencing court or a different sentence imposed as a consequence of individualized determinations and considerations. It's daunting, but I think it's something that needs to be done.
So goes back before a judge or goes before a parole board, or how does that work?
I think that these cases should go back before a judge to impose, as I said, either reimpose the sentence after a hearing or impose a different sentence after a hearing. It will take time, but I think that's the only way really to implement the Supreme Court's decision yesterday.
And do we know the oldest prisoner in Pennsylvania that is serving time having committed a crime as a juvenile?
Yes. The oldest prisoner in Pennsylvania is in his 70s, and he has been in prison for 59 years. He's here in Philadelphia for a crime that he committed when he was 15 years old. You know, this is an individual who has more than paid a price for the crime that he committed, has spent literally his entire life, his almost conscious life, in prison. One would hope that he is someone who actually would now have an opportunity to be released.
Let me turn to you before we get back to our callers here. But if what the court is saying is that juveniles get a second chance, and that's, I think, by taking the mandatory part away, at least it offers the possibility of a second chance. It does raise questions about what rehabilitation involves and whether the prison system is capable of taking a troubled, perhaps violent young person and turning them into a law-abiding adult.
Well, we certainly know that it's possible. Whether it happens in the correctional context that currently exists in Pennsylvania, is a different matter. One of the reasons that we have a separate juvenile justice system is that that system is equipped to provide rehabilitation, whether it's in the form of education or mental health services or substance abuse treatment, so forth. You're a lot less likely to get those kinds of services if you're in an adult prison than if you're in a juvenile facility. So I think that one of the challenges and one of the open questions, and we won't really know until we see how this plays out, is, well, what is the alternative in these kinds of cases? I mean, clearly, someone who's committed homicide needs to be sanctioned in a very, very serious way. The question is, if not life without parole, what is it going to be?
Yeah.
And is it going to be something that is going to permit somebody to have a second chance?
And because these are adults now. I mean, they may have committed the crime when they were teenagers, but they're adults now.
Certainly many of them, by the time they are sentenced and convicted, are going into prison probably past the age of 18. Mm-hmm. I think that the question that you raise is an important one, though, because in a way, we're dealing with this one step at a time. So we know that the sentence cannot at least automatically be imposed in cases of juveniles being convicted of homicide crimes. We also know that historically and presently, prisons are largely breeding grounds for crime. They're violent places themselves. Juveniles who have life sentences are often foreclosed from participating in any type of programs within the prison because there are few slots and they are reserved for individuals who will get out sooner.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that the challenge that also confronts us as advocates and researchers and experts in the field is also to turn our eyes to the prison system that has done a very poor job of thinking about rehabilitation as one of its goals. And I think we owe that to kids if we're going to put them into that system for a long time to give them something to come out with.
But you're saying they're kind of low on the totem pole in terms of services?
Yes, because of the fact that they are considered not likely to get out, and so there are just fewer opportunities available to them.
Like a triage in a way.
Yes.
Let me get Lamar from Elkins Park to join our conversation. Lamar, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to refer to a point that was made earlier in the conversation about the throwing of feces and urine by the young man who was incarcerated early in his life. The point that was being made then suggested that this is another indication of his mental illness. I think this is really an inaccurate point because the incarceration of people, especially young people, will cause symptoms of this sort to arise. And it's really very unfair to use that as an argument to suggest that this is by definition somebody who was damaged beyond repair. Not to suggest that this young man should not be kept safe and separate from society after his horrendous act, but to suggest that it's bad psychology to suggest that this indicates that he is mentally ill. Beyond what he already did, which is a pretty strong indicator.
Well, Lamar, let me give Lawrence Steinberg a chance to respond. Go ahead.
I think that's a fair point. What I heard the caller say, however, was that this was just one example of many instances of misbehavior. He described this prisoner as a troublemaker in prison, and there is a fair amount of research saying that individuals who misbehave within the prison context are riskier.
Lamar, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Mike from Allentown has to say. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm very supportive of the decision of the Supreme Court for the main reason that I never really understood the purpose of mandatory sentencing. I'd like to hear what your panelists say. If the purpose of prison is to protect society and deter and so on, is mandatory sentencing really a deterrent for a young criminal?
It's a good question, Mike. I'm going to toss that to Marshall Levick.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that the Supreme Court has tackled that question head on in this decision. The court has now actually said in a few cases that juveniles are not likely to be deterred by the prospect of sentences, even known sentences. And while as a nation I think that we have become increasingly punitive, we all know that, and we favor mandatory sentences because it provides a sense of certainty and clarity about what will happen in a particular situation. situation. These sentences are particularly ill-suited for juveniles. And I think that the words of Justice Kagan in her opinion yesterday were so clear in describing how essential it is that the attributes of youth, the hallmarks of youth, the impetuosity, the recklessness, the immaturity, that these are features that sentencers have to be able to consider in order to ensure that the sentence is a just one and that it's an appropriate one. I think that certainly Dr. Steinberg and I both agree that kids do need to be held responsible and accountable for what they do. If they commit serious crimes, they should probably face serious consequences. But we'd like those consequences to make sense, and we'd like them to be appropriate in a developmental way so that kids can actually benefit and return back to society if they have the opportunity.
Go ahead.
Let me address the caller's question about deterrence, because I think it's important to say that the same qualities of adolescence that Justice Kagan referred to in her opinion and that we've been discussing this morning, the same qualities that make adolescents less culpable than adults also make them much less likely to be deterred than adults, because someone who is going to be deterred has to be somebody who's thinking ahead and anticipating the consequences of the misdeed, right? And if you're not someone, because of your immature development, who is able to do that or likely to do that, then I think it's very, very improbable that you're going to be deterred by the fact that your state has mandatory sentencing. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that 99% of the juveniles who commit crimes in Pennsylvania have no idea whether there's a mandatory sentence for that crime or not.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's not an element that factors into their analysis at all and really doesn't serve the purposes of the justice system.
Let me get, looks like Joseph from Abington to join us on Radio Times. Joseph, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I wonder what the panel's response is. We have had a great deal of resources expended on punishment, prisons, and all kinds of systems. But there's hardly any money left for rehabilitation, especially with the review. I know it's going to be an expensive process. It all comes from the same pot. I wonder what all the Christians are saying, that on the one hand, you had to forgive and rehabilitate, but there's no money. All these governmental entities, especially in Pennsylvania in the current climate, we don't see any money coming sufficient to do a reasonable job of rehabilitating these people.
Well, fair enough. Go ahead, Larry.
Absolutely. And it's not simply that punishment takes money away from rehabilitation. It's that punishment is much more expensive than rehabilitation. So the cost of incarcerating someone in a prison, let's say in most states it's going to be $50,000 per person per year and up, and more expensive in places that have a higher cost of living, where wages for correctional workers are going to be higher. Well, you can provide rehabilitative services to an individual for much less than that. Mm-hmm. So we are wasting a lot of money by keeping somebody in prison for life. We also know that individuals almost never commit crimes once they reach their 30s. And so there's very little to be gained, even from an incapacitation point of view, by paying $50,000 a year to keep this person locked up for life beyond that age.
But do you think there's some suspicion about, you know, what therapy involves or what social services involve, that somehow it isn't, you know, the sort of punitive behind bars approach?
Well, you know, I think that sanctions in the justice system serve multiple purposes. I mean, one purpose is to punish the person. You know, one purpose is to deter other people from committing the same act. But another purpose ought to be to try to rehabilitate the person so that when that person comes back to the community, he or she mm-hmm. can be, a contributing member of society. And I think we need to resist the temptation to say that all we should do when somebody commits a crime is punish that person, because that's not all we should be doing.
Yeah, and I think that while I would like to think that it's a suspicion of therapy or programs of rehabilitation, I think we are a very punitive country. And I think that at this moment in time, we are much more interested in figuring out how we can impose punishments than we are in thinking about how we can creatively provide treatment or rehabilitation.
And does that make us different from a lot of the developed world?
We incarcerate more individuals in this country than any other country in the world. So, yes, our commitment to punishment is excessive and greater than any other country in the world right now.
I don't know if there's a case that's working its way before the Supreme Court, but is there more that you would, I mean, if, you know, it doesn't work this way, but Marcia, that you would like the Supreme Court to rule on when it comes to juvenile justice?
Well, I think that, you know, we talked a little bit about this idea of felony murder and someone being present but not actually directly participating in the murder of a victim. I really agree with Dr. Steinberg that the notion that kids are making the same judgments, foreseeing the same consequences as adults is not valid. We know that now from much of the research that he's been involved in. And I think we make a huge mistake when we continue to treat juveniles the same as adults across the board in criminal justice. So we've made sentencing strides, unquestionably, but I think that there is more that can be done in terms of accountability and responsibility. Again, not giving them a pass, but being smart about how we respond to juvenile crime.
And we're almost out of time here. I'm assuming you will continue to do the research that you have been doing on this issue?
Yes. I mean, we do the research for many purposes, right, including understanding risk behavior in general. But yes, we are continuing to do that work.
And a rich area to explore?
It is a very rich area to explore. And I think that the integration of behavioral science and neuroscience, which is what we do in our lab at Temple, and which is going on in other places, is very exciting.
Well, I appreciate the fact that both of you joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Lawrence Steinberg, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And he's a professor of psychology at Temple University. His research does focus on adolescent development. And Marcia Levick, thank you very much as well. And she's Deputy Director, Chief Counsel of the Juvenile Law Center. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, and the archives. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.